And if you want to follow it up next week, we can do so. But today we'll try and hit the major issues. So it says that the man knew his wife, Adam knew his wife Chava, and she conceived and had gave birth to Cain. And she said the word Cain is from Kinyan, to acquire something. I have acquired a man with God. And then she continued to give birth to his brother, Hevel. All right, so now you have the two sons. The eldest, the Bechor, was Cain, and the younger one was Hevel. And then it tells us that Hevel was a shepherd, and Cain was a farmer. Bear in mind that they don't give too much biographical information. The Torah hints at things, so every piece of information has to have some significance here in the story. Then it says it was at the end of days, at a period of time that went by, and Cain brought from the fruits of the field an offering to God. So this is the first example of somebody bringing a sacrifice.
Okay.
And Hevel brought also him. He also brought from the choicest of his sheep and the fat ones. And God turned to Hevel and to his offering. And to Cain and to his offering, God did not turn. God didn't acknowledge or accept. So, of course, why? What was the difference between one or the other? From the sukkim itself, from the text itself, we don't see any reason why God would accept the one above the other. It does indicate, well, that's the way we have to work it out. It does indicate that there was something special about Hevel's, but fine, so maybe Hevel's was a little bit better. But that still doesn't explain to us why Cain was not accepted. It explains to us why Hevel's was accepted. Let's assume that it was better. All right, but not everybody's on the highest, different level. He still brought a sacrifice. So we have to go a little bit further to understand why it was rejected. This was rejection. And Cain got exceedingly angry, caused him a tremendous amount of anger, and his face fell, which means that he had two reactions. What were the two reactions? Anger and depression. As a classical, Leiplupanov, his face fell. That means he was depressed. He was angry and upset. Those are the two reactions. It's universal. I mean, when a person does not get what they want, they usually have these. They usually get very angry, and they usually get very depressed. And the question of which one predominates depends on the situation, but those are the two classical emotional reactions. And God said to Cain, why are you angry? And why is your face fallen? Of course, God knew, but God wanted to draw it out of, to elicit it from him. God was trying to help him at this point. Is it not so that if you will do good, then your face will be uplifted? And if you do not do good, then sin crouches at the door. And its desire is unto you, but you can rule over it. Okay, this is to make a whole study just of this passage alone, this discussion. But God, let's take it on a simple level. We can analyze it separately. That's not the main focus of today's shiur. God is trying to essentially, what would you say is the main point in the message? The main idea of the message. God is, the purpose is, what is God's purpose anyway? Why is God even communicating with him at this point? He hasn't really done anything wrong, he's just angry and upset. So why is God communicating with him, and what's the main point of the message? Jackie? God's purpose obviously is to help him get out of the situation. He's stuck in the situation. But what is the main lesson in terms of... That's the point. That's the point, I would say. Of course, there's more to it. Essentially, the main message that God is communicating to him, this is true of everybody who has every kind. Everybody has had the experience of kind. And the experience is that you're angry and you don't get something that you want. And the reason that a person is angry and depressed, in his own mind, and he has two choices when this occurs to him, when he experiences something like this, he has two choices. That's what it boils down to. Because he's always looking to find the cause of his predicament.
A person by nature is always searching for the cause.
Who's at fault over here?
Now, the natural emotional response will be to pin the blame on something external to yourself. It's not me, it's something
outside of myself.
Now, as long as a person looks at it that way, so they're going to be angry. Of course, they're going to be blaming.
If a person is convinced that somebody is really harming him, is really preventing him from getting what he needs or from being happy or hurting him in any way, so then the natural reaction is going to be anger.
What I think God was pointing out to him was that
the reason,
do not look for the problem in anything external to yourself. It's essentially the reason why you feel this way is because of an inner defect.
See? Sin crouches at the door.
It's within you. And if you don't deal with it, its desire is unto you. It's going to consume your entire nature.
Because, you know, with the inclination, we discussed the Yesh Hara with the inclination,
the more you get into it, it's never satisfied.
It always wants more. And anytime you,
you know, you cater to something and
give in, I'll just give in this one time,
and then I'll be happy. That's
the attitude. If I just get, as we said, if I just get this one thing, I will be happy. That's the seduction.
It never works that way, because you find that after a
short period of time, you want more.
So, and every time you give in, you become a weaker individual, until it consumes you. Its desire is to consume you, to take over the entire personality. But the Atta, that's the final point of the message, you have, and then you deceive yourself by saying, in the end, your defense is, I couldn't help myself. I had such powerful emotions. I was overcome. That's the final defense. But God is saying, no, you have the power to control it. That there's no such thing as being unable to control it, because God who designed you is telling you that I placed within you another component, the Tzelem Elokim, the divine image, which has the power to overcome the instinctual forces. That's the message. So Kayan should have been extremely happy at this point.
Well, he's functioning rationally, he would have been extremely happy.
What could be greater than this? What could be greater to have a communication? People, everybody is in, the whole world is in darkness. Everybody's basically miserable. And everybody's struggling. And if, as soon as they find the first light that appears like any kind of salvation, they cling to it, and then they're disappointed. And it's the same thing now. Like, there's a big euphoria, a big change, you know, Clinton, it's all exciting. It's, you know, a few months, they'll have the same fetching. It's not going to happen. It's not going to get any better. It's not going to make a difference. Nor wouldn't have made a difference the other way either.
It would have been the same thing, except then people would have said, we should have done it on the other way. Okay, whatever it is.
But here you have a perfect situation over here. 99% of the problems in the country today, the people themselves, how they choose to live their lives, and what their values are, what they're chasing after. It's not, and the government itself, to whatever extent, it's the creation of the people. The government is only, the people don't want to see that. The government, the schools, etc., everything they're complaining about are basically the way they are, because they have responded to what the people have demanded. The problem lies within yourself. That's a tremendous thing, that God intervenes to make him aware that the defect lies within himself, and that if he devotes all of his energy to working on himself, then he'll achieve happiness. Then his face will be uplifted. Okay. But,
did it help?
Didn't help. So you see that also, even God's intervention doesn't necessarily have to work. So sometimes when you try and help somebody, and you give them good advice, and you think you really helped them, and it didn't work, don't have to feel so bad, because here, even God. Intervention, God's advice didn't work, because the reason why it didn't work was not because it wasn't the right advice. Because he has free will. He has the freedom to accept it or to reject it. So, then the next, this is a little bit of a difficult verse. It says, and Cain spoke to his brother Hevel. He spoke to him, but it doesn't say what he said to him. And it was when they were in the field, and Cain's stood up against his brother and he killed him. So we don't know what triggered off the dispute. We don't know why he killed him. We don't even know what the motive is.
It's very, it's
It's amazing. It's very hard to study the Torah without the Torah, without the Oral Law, without the commentaries. It would be impossible to make sense out of it. Because until now, we don't even know there's a problem between the two of them. First, there are the occupations. Then you have the sacrifices. He gets angry. But he's angry because his sacrifice was not accepted. The next thing, they're talking in the field, and then he kills him. Why did he kill him? What was the motive? Every murder has to have a motive. If it's because they got into some kind of an argument, then the Torah should have mentioned what that argument was. Rashi says about the talk that really he was just looking. That Cain, it says that Cain spoke to Hevel. Cain initiated. Cain was looking for an excuse. At this point, Cain hated, he obviously hated his brother. So here we have the first case of sibling rivalry. Okay? So, all your parents that are grappling with this issue, just relax. It's from the beginning. It was from the beginning. Sibling rivalry was programmed into the creation. But he was, the speech was, according to Rashi, it doesn't mention what it was because it really was not the key cause. Rather, the cause was deeper. But once he had the desire to kill him, he needed to find a pretext, an excuse, an argument. There's so many cases of these arguments are, you get involved in arguments, and you wonder why are we screaming at each other. The matter is not that significant. It's pretty trivial. Then you realize that something else is bothering you. Okay, so he killed him. Let's continue. God said to Cain, where's your brother Hevel? And he said, I don't know. Am I my brother's guardian? You see, just from this pasuk alone, from the response, okay, there's denial. But this is a classic illustration of another principle which I discussed during Tshuva. Denial, of course. Every sin, and we'll soon see it expressed more directly, every sin pulls a person further away from God. Every sin, no matter what it is, brings about a distortion in a person's relationship with God. Because it's preposterous. How could he say to God that he doesn't know? He's lying. How can you lie to God? Right? Lying, no matter where, when, whom, presupposes that the possibility is that the other person does not know the truth. So I'll try and get away with it. Maybe I will, maybe I won't, but obviously you're dealing with someone who does not necessarily have to know the truth. Therefore, by definition, you can't lie to God because God knows everything. You would not lie. You wouldn't, if you're caught, you know that the FBI has all the files, the videos, etc. And then they already have this in their possession. They've seen the whole thing. And now they're questioning you, they're grilling you, so you know you're not going to lie. They're just going to bring forth the evidence. So you'll cooperate, you'll tell the truth. The only time you lie is when you assume that maybe they're not sure, they don't know, there's a possibility I can get away with it. So you lie. You lie until you can't get away with it, until they have the smoking gun. So how can you lie to God? Isn't that astounding? And therefore you must conclude that at least at this moment, there's conviction about God's omniscience. That is to say that God is all-knowing. And that's one of the fundamentals of the Torah belief, that God exists and God is all-knowing, that nothing is hidden from God, that God knows what's in our hearts, our thoughts. God can read our minds, etc. That's part of our belief, that there's no place to escape from God. There's nothing that God is unaware of. Yet it would seem to me that at this moment in time, he was in a state of denial. Why? As a result of the sin. Sin causes a distortion of a person's ideas, especially ideas about God. And then God said, what have you done? The voice of the blood of your brother cries out to me from the earth. And the dam, the maid, the plural, actually, literally would be the blood. By the way, you see from this last week, we wanted to say that the voice, you listen, God said, because you listen to the voice of your wife. And I said it didn't mean literally there was speech, but the voice just meant the message that she was communicating. So you see that here too. It was the term kol, the same Hebrew word, the voice of the blood, the sound of the blood, the message of the blood. It doesn't mean literally that has to be speech. Okay. And now, cursed are you from the ground that opened its mouth to receive the blood of your brother from your hand. Right, now, this is what I want to analyze. The punishments. The punishments that God meted out to Cain. So the first one is that he's cursed from the ground. What does it mean? It means in addition to the original curse. Because God had already cursed it. Rashi points out, God, for Adam's sin, one of his sins was that the earth was cursed, in the sense that he now had to till the soil. And it brought thorns and thistles will bring forth. When he was in Gan Eden, the soil wasn't cursed. Everything came forth naturally, without labor. After his sin, the soil was cursed. But Rashi points out that he had a special curse, which was just for him. That he would find it almost impossible to produce anything, prosper through the soil. But what's interesting is, we have to explain why. How does he punish him for the crime? But when it mentions the soil, it mentions the soil which received the brother of your blood. Why is that? I mean, what's the difference? Let's say he would not have buried him in the... Is that because he buried him in the ground? He's being punished for burying him in the ground? Let's say he would have thrown him into the ocean. I assume that he still would have been... Because the punishment was not for the act of burying him. I imagine this is part of the punishment for the act of killing him. Once he killed him, he buried him. It's not a further crime. Right? So if you read the pasuk very carefully, there's something you should ask. Why does God mention the soil which received the blood? What do you mean? Of course it received the blood. Once you buried him there, it received the blood. What does that have to do? Why does that come to teach us? And then God explains what it means. When you till the soil, it will no longer give its powers to you. You won't, in other words, it's a real curse. A curse is this is the essence of a curse. You're not going to be matzliach. You want to have matzlacha. That's why when you bless somebody, you always say shef atzlacha. You should succeed. Because I guess that's the greatest blessing, because whatever person is involved in, whether it's profession, whether it's family, whether it's raising children, what a person wants is atzlacha. To succeed. But to put in, I guess there's no greater curse than that. To work on something, to put in all your energy into something, and not to see it succeed is a terrible curse. Where do you see that in the Torah? Recognize this, another illustration? Redemptions. Under a Jewish state, when they go out to war, it's a Mohammed Smith, you know. This would be a Mohammed Rishus, actually. But there's exemptions. Those who are exempted, deferments, who are legitimately deferred from military service under a halachic society, would be the person who was betrothed, had betrothed the wife, but had not established a household. So, or had established, who had built a new house and hadn't lived in it yet. Or had planted a vineyard and hadn't eaten from it yet, was in that transitional stage. And all, lest he die, let him go back, return to his wife, lest he die in the war, and another man will marry her. So it seems, and Rashi points out, and that's agmas nefesh, that's a tremendous amount, that's a source of tremendous anxiety to a person. What's the source of anxiety? There's all kind of, well, you could say anybody that's going out to war is always a... That's something that he doesn't, you know, he's leaving behind. No one wants to die in war. The answer is, though, that there are certain things that are even more painful. That when a person's these are all people that have been in the process of building something, constructive endeavor, which is important for them and important for society. So once a person, let's say a person has a family, all right, he'd have to go and fight. He's married 3 years. He doesn't have this exemption anymore. He'd say the same thing. Lest he die. The answer is, at least he can accept the fact that he achieved his objective. He married, he established a family, whatever. So, of course, he'd like to live longer and enjoy it, but he recognizes that he may have to go fight. But that's different than the one who's on the way. He's involved in building something. And he's just about to experience the fulfillment of that. To die at that point is extremely painful. Not to see the fruits of your endeavors. That's like a curse to a person. That's like a curse that he was involved in building something and it failed. Failed. It didn't come to fruition. It's a hard thing. So that's what God's saying. This is you will not achieve any success anymore in this area. Then we have another thing though. Nova notia baret. Baret. You'll be a wanderer. A wanderer, and that's Noah. Noah means someone who's always moving, on the move. And the Noah means, like, Menuda, would be like one who was excommunicated. You'll always be a stranger. You'll be a perennial stranger. And you'll be moving, you'll never achieve any permanent. You'll always be the outsider. You'll never achieve any permanent state of security. And Cain said to God, God love on himself, my sin is too great to bear. So what do you have over here? Confession. Confession. He confessed. And then he lists what God has done. You have driven me. Behold, you have gerashta. That's for gerishin. Gerishin means divorce. You have driven me today from off the face of the earth. In other words, I can't work the earth anymore. You've taken away my livelihood, my profession, my involvement. And from your face I will be hidden. That's where the idea. And also he realizes that he can never have the same relationship with God. He can't, so to speak, be face to face with God where he was originally. Originally he had a different relationship with God. He was able to, so to speak, of course, to look at God in the face, which of course cannot be taken literally, but you know what I mean. So he's cut off from the earth, hidden from God's face, and I'll be a wanderer and an outsider in the land, and it'll be whoever finds me will kill me. And God said, therefore, whoever kills Cain will be paid back sevenfold. And God established a sign for Cain so that he shouldn't be killed. Rashi says that God carved out his sign for him on his forehead. All right, I want that to be taken. We're not going to get into that at the moment. This is that Cain went forth from before God. That's the end of the story. Now, the major issues that I want to take up are, what would you say? Well, I want to explain how these punishments fit the crime. All right? In order to do so, of course, we have to understand the nature of the crime. So basically, what was the nature of the crime? And how did these punishments fit into the picture? Because he's being punished with a number of things. With the fact that he can no longer have success in working the ground. Right, that he's a perpetual wanderer. He's a the outsider. He's a refugee. He's always moving from place to place. He can never find permanence. And he can't write. He's cast away from the presence of Kenethi and the presence of God anymore. Alright. Let's just pause for a moment. There's a very interesting point I wanted to bring out. We now see two distinct reactions to confrontation with sin. When Adam was first confronted with his sin, what did he say? The woman made me do it. We did that last week. So he didn't deny that he did it, but he just said it's not really my fault. It's her fault. And by association, he was implicating God, the woman that you placed with me. As we said, all blame ultimately is blaming God. When he was first confronted with it, what was his reaction? I didn't do it. Total denial. Now, again, you see, these are the two, I think, classic prototypes of how a person avoids facing up to his responsibility. Either through distortion. Adam was guilty of distortion. He distorted the situation. And Cain denied it completely, which is interesting. But you see that today in our society that people can, you wonder how people can actually do this. Now you read about these people that were killers, committed the worst possible crimes. This guy in everybody, I'm sure, I was struck by this case in New Jersey. Remember the one who killed his family and even his mother and his children, his wife? That was like a mess. List. His name was List. He was in New Jersey. And they only got him. He had totally escaped. It was like, because of that television program, Most Wanted. You remember about that?
And I read the fact of the case, I read a book about it, because it just fascinated me. What fascinated me, he was like an ordinary, plain individual, hard-working person, very religious and so forth. It was like an amazing kind of a case. Like, how could a person like that, an ordinary person like that, always was meticulous, you know, went to work every day, struggling along. And he was extremely religious, extremely active in church. And he did something which is almost unbelievable. I mean, he killed his... He was very close to his mother. He killed his mother, his wife, and I think he had 3 children. And then he just disappeared and went out west to Colorado and was very clear. Yeah, for a number of years, he was just trying to find a little work, whatever, live a quiet life, got involved in the church again, and he finally remarried. Then he was caught as a result of this program. The thing that amazed me the most was that, all right, for whatever, what could drive a person to actually do that is one thing. But that I could, knowing the human psyche, you know, all kinds of, you know, unconscious forces, whatever. But having done it, how can he then live with himself? That's what amazed me. When you read about, he went out west, and he got some work, and he in fact, he said he really enjoyed his life out there, even before the time that he got married. He got into a routine, and he worked, he watched television, he'd read the newspaper, he had his whole routine. What he said, for the first few years, he would think about it on the anniversary of the murders, he'd think about it, you know, but the rest of the year didn't. Now, it just seems to me, how is that possible? Let's say a person went crazy, berserk, whatever, and did something horrible. But then he would, afterwards, he just couldn't live with himself. Okay. Well, you happen to be right. See, I find that, I guess each person finds different elements of a thing to be amazing. Some people would find the fact that how can a person kill their own child? You know? Each person, how could you do that? For me, the most amazing part, it's of course hard to see and all that, but I could see that. I could see that a person could do that. But having done it, I can't see how the person could live with it. That's, for me, the most difficult thing to imagine. And yet you see that people, and what we see today, every day, these serial killers in their private lives, they could be committing the worst atrocities, and then they go into work every day, and they're cheerful and friendly, like, and they're not schizophrenic in the true clinical sense. I don't mean that. They're not, a schizophrenic is one who has 2 separate personalities. Like, when he's in one personality, he does not know what he's doing in the other personality. That we have a case in Tanakh, like Shaul. Shaul had a psychosis and he wanted to kill David. But when he was lucid, he recognized that David had not sinned. The capacities for a person to simply suppress, exactly. You see that it's possible. And that he just refuses. In other words, it wasn't, when he denied it, when Cain denied it, it wasn't like he was like shaking and feeling horrible and just denying it. He felt very calm, very comfortable. He was very calm. A person has the capacity to simply block out something to separate it as though it never happened. It just didn't happen. I didn't do it. And these people that are so slick in court, you know, when they keep denying it, the reason why they're so successful at convincing people is because they've been able to convince themselves. In other words, even though factually they know they did it, but that fact has lost any emotional significance to them. It's as though they didn't do it. It's as though somebody else did it. It's as though it never happened. So a person like that can even beat the lie detector test. That's an amazing kind of thing. And that was kind. Now let me ask you a question. Of these two reactions, which one is worse? Which of these two reactions would you say is a worse? Who is more corrupt? Which one is worse? Adam, who did not deny that he ate the fruit, admitted the crime, but deflected the blame. Or Cain, who simply denied that it ever happened. Denial. You're saying, well, the standard, the natural answer would be to say that he's worse, right? Okay. But in terms of what? Okay. Okay, okay. In terms of, yeah, there's 2 ways we can look at it. Yeah, that's the interesting thing. The interesting thing is that we do not find that Adam actually did tshuva. It doesn't say that. But Cain did do complete tshuva. In fact, that's why he was saved. Really, he was deserving of death. Now, Chazal tells the story that Adam and Cain were walking one day. And They said they have to be taken literally. They bumped into each other. And they're illustrating a point through a conversation. And Adam said, how did you survive? Because he was guilty, certainly killed for killing. How were you able to beat the rap, so to speak? So Cain said, because I confessed. So Adam said, well, if I'd have known how easy it is, then I would have confessed. Because he couldn't beat the rap, he was given the punishment, he was starting to get Eden. Why? Because he didn't, apparently, it's conceivable that had he confessed, he didn't confess. So who was further from, in terms of who was further from confession, there's a difference. Yeah. Why is that? Sometimes it is distortion, distorting something is worse than the denier. Anyone's a school teacher. See, the student that denies, I didn't do it. That's all he's maintaining. But that person, once he's confronted, all he's saying is, I didn't do it. And you can't prove it. Now, once he's confronted with the fact, that's it. Now, your task, see, basically your task is easier. Because all you have to do is to confront him with the proof. Here, yeah, I have the proof, you did it. Then he has no... Yeah. Now, one who goes to... Someone who's more corrupt, he's like... Yeah, like you see a lawyer in court, you take the very same set of facts, which any reasonable person would lead to this conclusion, and twist it and distort it to such an extent that it confuses the jury. That person, their very thinking process become corrupted. So how are you going to win that person back? With what? With reason? I mean, you have all the information right there. It's right in front of you. As far as reason is concerned, he can play around anything you say into a different twist, a different plan. That person is already... See, once the mind is being corrupted in terms of how it thinks, the only thing you have left is your mind. Once you've sinned, so you've made a distort. There's a distorting of reality. You've gone away from the truth. So what can I appeal to? Your reason. I can appeal to your reason. You did the wrong thing. So as long as you just did the wrong thing, but your reason is still intact, your power of reason is intact, I can deal with you. I'll explain to you. I'll show you. But the problem is that having sinned, you now seek to justify what you're doing. Now when you justify what you're doing, you start to rationalize. Now you're distorting your whole thinking mechanism. You're not thinking straight anymore. So that becomes much more difficult to save you, to explain to you that you're doing the wrong thing. So who was worse in terms of a distortion of their rational faculty? Was Adam, not Cain. Cain just put it aside, refusing to face it. But once you turn his face around and you make him face it, then he said, go along yourself. Because he had not distorted his powers of interpretation. So that's a different twist.
And we like to believe.
Well, from the fact that God actually protected him.
Yes.
God protected him because he said that I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get killed in this situation, and God took measures, whatever they are, the sign, the mark, to save him. So therefore, God knew that his tshuva was a good tshuva. Let's try and understand the nature of the sin. What was the difference between Cain and Abel? What was the difference? Yeah, the first difference... Right, the first difference was that one was a shepherd and one was a farmer. Does that tell you anything? Rashi. Rashi says on... Right. It says... Rashi on Beis now, on Dalet Beis 4:2, Roetzon, a shepherd, Lefi Sheniskal Lohadama, because the earth was cursed, God had cursed the earth already, Pireishlo Me'avodoso, he separated himself from working it. That's all it tells us. Now, on the base of this clue, we have to try and explain. This indicated a certain character difference between the two of them right from the start. What is the difference? One more item over here. With regard to the sacrifice itself, of course we have to understand why, what motivated the sacrifice. But we pointed out before, okay, I'll give you that clue in a second. We pointed out before that there was a difference between the two sacrifices. And that is, with regard to Cain, it just says he brought from the fruit. Simply, and Rashi says, from the fruit, from the garua, from the inferior ones. That he brought it from the inferior ones. Just from the way it describes it, indicates that from the... Right.
from the inferior ones. And yeah, it wasn't that cheating. I wouldn't call it cheating. Ah, right. See, that adds another element to the picture. Perhaps there'd be nothing wrong. I don't know what the choice of a farmer, being a farmer, but you see that he had a certain defect in the sacrifice that he brought. Whereas Havel, is it by accident, in other words, that was the choice of being a shepherd, and the fact that when he gave, he brought from the choice, from the best? Was there a relationship between the two? And the fact that by Cain, his choice of being a farmer, and the fact that he brought from the inferior, was there a relationship between the two? Now we can try and explain. See, I said there's nothing wrong with what, you know, Cain with wanting to be a farmer, right? There's nothing wrong necessarily with that. But, see, Hevel was also attracted to that area. Hevel was attracted, but then he decided not to. Because if he was just attracted to being a shepherd, it wouldn't mention that he needed the reason because the earth was cursed. He also was attracted to that, but he withdrew from it because he realized that it wasn't worth it. There was a tremendous amount of labor involved. And I thought it was Rashi. Now, why did he bring the sacrifice? He brought the sacrifice because he had been. Because of the fact that he had been attracted to the working of the land, but he wanted to work on that emotion. So I would say like this, that a person can become a farmer for two different reasons. One can be pure practicality. It's the best way that he has to getting what he needs. Or else there's another fact. In other words, he has an attachment to the soil for other reasons. It gives him a false sense of security. Yeah. A person has to deal. Each person, one of his most primary drives is the need for security. A person feels insecure. And he seeks to satisfy this feeling in different ways. I mean, he has a tremendous need, the sense of immortality. That's a very big thing on people's minds. Now, people turn to certain things to satisfy that emotion. The truth of the matter is, it's an emotion which can't be satisfied. A person has to... The only security a person can have in this world is the fact that he has faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the world is the result of God's handiwork, and that if he follows the will of God, then he has to succeed. It has to be good. But if that doesn't give him any comfort, he needs certain particulars, physical. It's what people pursue wealth. What is wealth? And people don't pursue it to spend it, as we mentioned last week, because everybody leaves it over. As I told you last week, there's no millionaire. The only intelligent millionaire would be one who dies penniless. That's the Gemara. It was Ben Azai. Ben Azai was an individual who tried to live his life and to work exactly for what he needed. And then as soon as he had what he needed, that's it. He stopped working. He learned Torah. So he obviously didn't have a tremendous bank account. When he was about to die, he saw what he had to leave over. He had a couple of pieces of buckser. You know how buckser is, like the carob. Like nothing, a couple of pieces. And his students were there, and he began to cry. What's the matter? He says, concerning me, there's a pasuk. The pasuk says, they've left their wealth over to others. Azbul acherim chelam. Azbul acherim chelam, which is really criticizing these people that spend their whole lives amassing fortunes, and they leave it over to others. Which is, the Torah recognizes that that's a stupid thing to do. In other words, the idea of making money to leave it over to others, the Torah considers a stupid thing to do. There's no point. You're wasting your life. God gave you time. Time is the most important thing to achieve a certain objective. Of course, within that framework, you have to work to obtain the necessities. But once you obtain the necessities, you should now devote yourself to perfecting the soul, not to leaving over to others. So the more that you work for that which you don't need, that's all wasted effort. It's completely wasted effort. And the Gemara considers that possibility. Oh, but they'll praise you. Perhaps others will praise you, the Gemara says. The Gemara, what about your children? The Gemara raises all of these issues. Well, you leave it to your children. What's wrong with that? Your children will have.
The Gemara says, no, the children can work for themselves. Let them work for themselves. You don't have to work. That's not your responsibility. Your responsibility is not to work your whole life, so to leave out that your children shouldn't enough money, your children shouldn't have to work. That's not your responsibility. You have to take care of yourself. You can leave out a little bit. Yeah, that's part of tzedakah. That's part of that. But that's not, but that doesn't require each person within his means. Of course, he devotes some time to chesed. That's very important. I didn't mean to knock that. But to say that I'm going to spend my whole life amassing a fortune of money, so that I'll make $1 billion and I'll leave it over to the poor. That would be, that's not your job. That would be foolish, actually.
Yeah. Well,
that is clearly would be a problem. Right. That's not in line with that view. That's just a question for that point of view. So, one second. We'll ask that question, why they go to sacrifice in the room. But I just want to show the difference in the character. That they'll see, Hevel also had that attraction, that need for security. And land, real estate, has a tremendous, gives you a tremendous sense of security. And that's why the home is so important to a person. And that's why the whole philosophy behind the mitzvah of sukkah is to leave your home and to realize that there is no, that this world is basically like a temporary hut. And if you're under the protection of God, that's all you need. And if you're not under the protection of God, you can build the mightiest fortress and it won't help. But nevertheless, that's what people are attracted to. And apparently, you see the attraction that the physical, the material held for Cain, in that when it came to sacrifice, since he was in a conflict, he wanted God too, he wanted both. But did he want God because of the true reason? Or did he want God because, as most people are religious, they want a little extra on their insurance policy? I mean, they want to cover all their bases. So he did want to be in God's favor. He wanted God's favor. But it wasn't on the highest level. He wanted God's favor, but he also wanted to partake of the physical.
But you say not only was it not on the highest level, it was a distorted
thing. It was a distorted thing, exactly. It was a distortion, right. Because you're right, in his own mind, he was a tzaddik. He was a tzaddik. As many people seek to do. You know, a lot of people seek to, they want to have it both ways. They're tied to the physical, so they want to hold on to their money, but they want respect and honor, so they have to give charity, but then they work that in a way where, you know, whatever. I mean, they're getting a little... Yeah, I mean, they work that in various ways. So they could have... So then they can show the public that they're big tzaddikim, they gave charity, and at the same time they're not losing so much, whatever the case may be. You know the phenomenon. Interestingly enough, Hevel was a tzaddik though. Hevel had the same attraction. But he thought it over. So he analyzed the situation. And he realized that it wasn't the best thing for him to do. Because the earth had been cursed. And really, so why should he put all of his effort into working the earth, when he could have an easier situation through being a shepherd? Because the only purpose, see, a shepherd, being a shepherd does not cater to that sense of permanence of, yeah, earth is something which is the land, you have a farm. I mean, it gives you a certain sense of permanence. With sheep, you can't have that same sense. I mean, it's, yeah, it's, you can't attach yourself. There's nothing in sheep that can give you a sense of security. You can't attach yourself to anything. So, moreover, the life of a shepherd was a much easier life, because a farmer has to work very hard, and he has to plant at the right time, and be affected by weather conditions, and so on and so forth. It was cursed. Which means to say that there's a greater pull on your energy. And if a person wants to be involved in thought and in learning, so that's not the field to go into. So, Hevel, though he had that attraction, was able to pull back from it and perfect himself and get over that need. So he had the proper relationship to the physical. See, that's why he brought a sacrifice. The reason why he brought a sacrifice was because he wanted to work on his perfection. Because see, it's not enough. See, it's not enough for a person to simply refrain from doing that which is wrong. He wanted to constantly be aware of the fact that he had these emotional tendencies and that he could fall prey to them again in a different situation. And that was the purpose of the sacrifice. The purpose of the sacrifice Well, let me just talk to you about what you say. What was the idea of the sacrifice? The problem is, I'm not going to take up the entire issue of sacrifice, the whole philosophy of sacrifice and all the different opinions. That's a little tangential to the subject. See, the Rambam has a different attitude to sacrifice. The Rambam held that really, ideally, the Torah would not have permitted sacrifices. Well, you know, in the Beis Hamikdash and all that, because he held that it's something which could lead to the corruption of a person's relationship to God. But the Torah only allowed it, he said, because the mentality of people in those days, sacrifice was such an integral part of religious observance that if you wouldn't have given it to them, then you couldn't have had any religion at all. In the same way, he says, like, what's in today? We start a religion, and in this religion, we wouldn't have the idea of praying. You couldn't win people over, because praying is an integral expression of the religious personality. So he says, in the same way, when the Torah was given in that time, the idea of sacrifice had a tremendous hold on people. Well, even today, a lot of these crazy cults, you know, they're drawn to this thing of sacrificing. But this is not, we're not dealing here with crazy people. This is a different situation. But you have to understand why the Rambam didn't like, you know, was what's wrong with sacrifice is that it lends itself to a false idea. Very easily lends itself to a false idea that, see, when primitive people bring a sacrifice, it's based upon an emotion. They're projecting human qualities onto God. And the idea is that they're propitiating the gods. All of these primitive tribes that all, you know, that have their religion, they bring sacrifices, and sometimes even human sacrifices. In their own very primitive psyche, they have this notion that there are various forces, gods out there, that are human-like, because they project human-like qualities onto them, and that you win their favor by propitiating them, by appeasing them with these sacrifices. See, that's a very dangerous notion. Because any idea that we have that we could do anything for God, that's idolatry. If any person believes that he's making God happy, I mean in a literal sense, but what was he doing then? What was he doing? The essence of the deed, it would be very much akin. See, the value of the karban, of the sacrifice, is insofar as it helps you to break away from your attachment to the physical. Because where does the attachment lie? To the best, the fattest, the choicest. In other words, if you're a materialist, that's what you really want. You want the best. The others you don't care about. But if you're not a materialist, and you're simply a shepherd out of practicality, it's nothing to you. So therefore you don't have any attachments to this one, to that one. You want to. In fact, why did they enact the sacrifice? Because still, since we're human, we have to enact certain things. By enacting something, it brings it home, it has an effect upon your emotions. We're separating the best and giving it to God, which is to say that we recognize that all this comes from you, everything we have comes from you, and therefore it's all intended to be used in the service of God. That the only benefit that we have from the physical is that it leads us to the service, it enables us to be involved in the service of God, and that's the only good that the physical has. So of course you can think about these ideas in your mind, or you can do an actual deed which helps you. It's more.
Is it like a form of humility?
It's humility, but it's reverence. It's reverence. It's a natural outpouring of the true attitude that a person should have towards everything. That everything that we have comes to us from God, and what's the purpose of it all? The purpose of it all, what's the ultimate good of everything? Is that not that we have these physical enjoyments, because that's not the real good, but that we live in a situation that we have the capacity to partake of that which is real, the ultimate good, and that is to be aware of the Creator and to partake of something which only we can partake of outside of God, and that is the Chachmas Hashem, that we can have a relationship with God. That's the ultimate good. That's why I was discussing this morning that the highest day of perfection is when a person experiences Avod Hashem, love of God. Now, that's a very hard state to achieve. Most people are not in that state. But I said that if a person does not have Avod Hashem, then he's really corrupt, philosophically corrupt, there's something wrong with him. And why?
Because it means that the total distortion of his of the situation in which he's living. If somebody, if you were in a terrible situation, a terrible, terrible, catastrophic, you know, situation, and there was no one to help you, all your friends had abandoned you, and you're facing the worst nightmare possible, and a complete stranger comes along, looks at the situation, and goes out of their way and saves you and brings you into a situation of, you know, tremendous salvation, so to speak, what would your feeling be towards that person? That person didn't know you, didn't get anything out of it, just did it purely out of their own sense of compassion. Wouldn't you have a natural sense of gratitude? Like, I wasn't deserving, I wasn't entitled, I couldn't make a claim on you, and you, out of your own sense of compassion, came and gave me the ultimate benefit and took me out of the ultimate horror. Well, if that's the case, isn't that our situation? We didn't deserve, we had no claim, God didn't have to create us. The very fact that we exist, the very fact that we have existence, and that we have a Tzelem Elokim, that is to say that God endowed us with something which is in some way akin to the, some way reflects the nature of God, enabling us to partake of His wisdom for no reason whatsoever. Each person feels entitled and upset. We're not entitled to anything. We have no claim on God. God didn't have to create us. He did so only because of His own quote-unquote compassion, which means out of His perfection. So you find yourself in this situation, shouldn't you just have a natural sense of gratitude? Now, how many people don't feel that way about life? Well, what's wrong? There's got to be something wrong somewhere. If you don't feel that way, just happy, happy to be alive and thankful to God, then you're not living properly. You're not living properly. It means you're pursuing the wrong things. People are miserable because they're not getting there like Kayan. They're depressed. And the only reason is because they're not getting what they want. But that's only because what they want is not what God intended for them. Because if you truly wanted what God intended for you, and that which is really best for you, then you'd be happy. You have to be that way. And that's why the only happy people are tzaddikim. The only happy people are tzaddikim. And anybody who's not a tzaddik really cannot be happy, I don't think. Maybe momentarily. They're always looking forward around the corner. So and momentarily they think they're happy, but then they're depressed again. They can't imagine why, they just don't get it on a steady, can't keep it going. So we're going to have to, we'll do part two of the story of Cain and Hevel. Alright, sort of like let's see if we could bring ourselves up to date here. We left off. We had discussed, analyzed last week the difference between the two individuals. We said the Chumash doesn't give us much information, but the choice of occupation seems to be a major factor, according to Rashi. The fact that Hevel deliberately shied away from being a farmer, from tilling the soil, because it was cursed, so to speak, in that it involved a lot of effort, a lot of labor. And while he was, see, Piresh means he separated himself from it, which means that he also had the attraction. And we said that there was an attraction, a difference between being a shepherd and being a farmer, in the sense that it does provide a person with a certain sense of security when he has something which is permanent. So we tied it into a person's need for permanence, for immortality, to remove his insecurity. A person feels insecure. Being a shepherd doesn't cater to those emotions. So we said that Hevel, the fact that he chose to be a shepherd indicated a certain perfection, that he had overcome these emotions. But Cain, in spite of the fact that the land was cursed, he decided to do it anyway, which meant that he had greater needs for the physical goods in life. They had more significance to him. Then we took up the fact of the sacrifice. They both brought sacrifices to God. And one was accepted and one wasn't. So the question is, why did God accept the sacrifice of Hevel and rejected the sacrifice of Cain? So I think we answered that question, although you left off the question as to the sacrifice. Yeah. Now, with the case of the sacrifice, we said the Torah indicates that there was a difference in what was brought. That is, that Hevel brought from the choicest one, and the best. And with regard to Cain, the indication according to Rashi is that he didn't bring from the best, or he be brought from the inferior one. Now that's a significant difference. So we said, what was the concept? What was the idea of bringing a sacrifice in the first place? At this point, what was the idea? So we said that, just in general terms, that to bring a sacrifice to God, as we mentioned, could lead to false ideas of God. One has to be very careful. In the sense that a person's primitive tribes brought sacrifices for the wrong reason, because they projected their own needs onto God. And they thought that they were appeasing God. But their whole concept of God was a false one. They thought they were appeasing. Now that there's the danger. And I pointed out the relevance to our situation. Many, even though we don't bring sacrifices, but this is a very powerful emotion. We somehow feel, and you know, the back of our mind somewhere, that if we don't serve God, if we don't do the mitzvot, or conversely, if we do the proper thing, that we're doing it for God. I think each person has a vestige of this idea that he has to deal with. We do have a lingering sense that we're doing, in other words, we may feel bad if we don't do a mitzvah, or if we do the wrong thing. We sometimes have it like we let God down. We didn't act properly towards God. Yeah, we sort of, well, maybe it's what we sort of, we're upset with ourselves, and we're a little bit afraid because God is upset with us. We sort of have the feeling that God is upset with me, and I'm going to suffer for it. Conversely, when a person may do a good deed, he may have the other feeling that he feels good now. Because he may not think this out consciously, but sort of he feels that God's happy with me. I did it for God. I went out of my way for God. Now, if you think this through, logically, you have to realize the yitzdak, we say it on Elah, if a person acts righteously, mayifalo, there's nothing you're doing for God. The purpose of doing the fulfilling the Torah and the mitzvot cannot, a person can never imagine that he's doing anything for God. For to imagine so would be a defamation of God. You're saying that God needs our service, that God is somehow lacking, and that we have it in our power to either benefit God or conversely to harm God. Now, if anyone has that notion, then he's entertaining a false idea about God. God is not made any happier by our keeping the Torah. Even though the Torah does use that type of terminology, that God will rejoice over us when we do the good. That just means to say, the Torah was expressed in the language that a child can relate to it. But when you grow up, you have to revise these notions. It means that we're acting in accordance with God's will. It's God's will, which we can't understand. Because the question, I'm not going to take it up now, but the question is, why did God even create us? And we say it's purely, well, the Rambam says it's the will of God, or you could say the wisdom of God, which is equal to God's will. God is invisible. And it's God's will, which we can never fathom. So he says, to understand why, we have to realize that it was not because God had this need, which is satisfied through us. It's totally, when we associate the idea of creating something, we only create something to satisfy a certain need. So no individual is going to expend his labor to create something unless it satisfies a need or an imaginary need, whatever the case may be. But with regard to God and creating us, you can't say the same thing. So then, of course, why did? We don't know. In order to understand, we'd have to be able to understand the nature of God, which we can't understand. So we have to take it in the framework of chesed. Of chesed, that it's not in the sense that we didn't deserve it. It stems from the nature of God. Now, all of the mitzvot then, the purpose of doing all the mitzvot is not to make God happy, but rather it's all intended for our benefit, for our perfection. The only one that you can hurt by not doing the mitzvot is yourself primarily, and of course others by association. You can hurt others, but primarily it's yourself. And when the only one you can benefit through doing the mitzvot is, of course, yourself. Of course, you benefit others too because they learn from you. But it's for mankind. It's not for the sake of it. Can't help God in any way other than that it's in line with God's will. Now,
to be sacrificed. The purpose then of bringing a sacrifice was, in this case, was not to propitiate God in any way, but it was purely for their own perfection. And it's an enactment of an idea. What was the idea? The true idea of a sacrifice should be that everything that exists in the physical world comes to us as a blessing from God. That's how we should look at it. We're not entitled to it in any way. And it's intended to be utilized for a specific purpose. Not to, the physical bounties of this world are not to be regarded as the good. If a person looks at the physical as the good, and he strives for it as an end in itself, he's never going to find happiness, because the physical cannot satisfy a person in and of itself. It's a gift from God to be utilized to fulfill the true purpose, which is in the perfection of a person's spiritual nature, which means his whole relationship to God, through appreciation of the wisdom of God, and so forth. That's the idea. Okay? But, so why bring a carbon? Why not just review the idea in your mind? Right? That's the next question. And the answer is, I mean, according to me, that's the way it makes sense to me. There could be other answers. But you see that Judaism, while the essence of the Torah is the true ideas that it teaches us, but it does not negate the importance of emphasizing these ideas through certain concrete demonstrations. Like you have a mezuzah on the doorpost to remind you of the idea of God, that when you enter into your house, you should recognize that the house is a protection for your physical being, but also you should realize that there's another part of you, there's the soul, that also requires protection. So why don't we just think of this idea? The answer is that a person is affected by certain physical things. He sees it on the doorpost, it has an effect upon him, and so on and so forth. And that's why, I mean, the Seder, all the mitzvot, they take ideas and it dramatizes and expresses these ideas in a way that affects our emotions as well. Because we're not just the robots, we're not just rational beings. We're human beings with emotional needs and so on and so forth. So the ideas have to be given over in a way that affects the whole person. That's the brilliance of Torah. And the idea of a carbon is that it's different. It's one thing to say, to sit down and discuss this idea that everything that we take from the physical world should be viewed as a blessing in the service of God. But it's quite different when you actually take something. And you actually have to part with something. It's like giving tzedakah. Everybody loves the idea, you know, in the abstract, it's a wonderful thing. But in the concrete, in the particular, it's not the same thing. When, you know, a person can talk about how important it is to give tzedakah. And then when somebody comes to you and needs a certain amount, and so then it becomes a different issue. Well, you're thinking, well, how much do I need, and what I was praying, is to actually part with the money. You see, the real perfection is in the deed. Insofar as that deed brings home to you the concept behind the idea of giving tzedakah. So you have to have both. The person just gives tzedakah out of rote, or whatever the case may be, not understanding the real philosophy, will get some benefit, but he won't get the true benefit. So you have to have the idea. But if a person just works on the idea and doesn't practice it, doesn't enact the giving, it's not going to be perfected either. So therefore, in our system, perfection comes about through two things, through knowledge and through the implementation of that knowledge in our life. So that's the idea of a carbon. Okay? Now, so the carbon of Hevel was acceptable to God. Because why was it acceptable? God turned to it. God accepted it. Why? Because it reflected the true idea of carbon. And the true perfection of the individual behind it. Not that God liked a choice. See, a person can make a mistake. It's not that God likes the object better. But God did not accept the carbon of Cain. Let's turn to Jackie has a question real quick. Why did Cain bring the carbon all together? What motivated Cain? Now, Hevel, we understand. Hevel was a perfected individual. And he was working on his own emotions. And he realized that he was working on his emotions, because he also was attracted to working the soil, but he separated. He was poresh. He was involved in separating himself. So he was a perfected individual. But Cain, why did he bring a carbon? I mean, we shouldn't have too much difficulty identifying with this type of thing, that a person wants to have the best of both worlds. And that is, he didn't deny God, but his relationship to God was not based upon the true foundation. he was preoccupied with his need for security to satisfy his emotions, but he didn't go about it in the correct way. So he wanted God too.
I mean, I'm not saying he was a Russia, not at this point. Of course, later on he killed his brother.
But it's not unusual to find, even in the world of criminals, that Jewish or Gentile, they can be involved in all kinds of underhanded illegal activities, and they can be extremely generous in giving. In fact, it's just the opposite. They want to cover. They want to cover their. Yeah, he's not the only one, of course. Yeah, but not only God, you find a lot of amongst the Jews also. I mean, what's that? Yeah, boasting, all these different people. They're very charitable. But that charity is not for the true reason. In fact, it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable. It's not a genuine act of they're just doing it to fool themselves, to obtain a full sense of security. Well, they're doing it, of course, for the public. But it's not just for the public. Of course, it's good for the public, but it's not only that. It's for within their own minds, they look at themselves as being extremely righteous people. And they'll point to the amounts they've given in their own defense. They do not view it in their own minds as we do. Now, they're not that cynical about it. They'll say, okay, maybe I did something wrong, but I did a great deed of charity. But what we're saying over here is that the sacrifice of Cain was really devoid of meaning. Because it didn't achieve the objective. The objective of the carbon was really to bring about a change in his relationship to the physical. And it didn't do so, because he retained the best, and by giving that which he didn't need, not only was it not helping him, but it was harming him. See, carbon can be a negative thing as well. And that's the concept that's brought out it's brought out in Tehillim, I believe, that the reason for the destruction of the... I'm not sure where. Chazal, God took out his anger, so to speak, on wood and stone with regard to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That when the Jews reached a certain point of corruption, then the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, had to be destroyed. Because now it was bad for them to have a temple. Because by having a temple, it only made it worse, because they could go ahead and lead a sinful life, and in their own minds, they just come and bring a sacrifice, and you're absolved. It's very akin to the Christian notion, so to speak. So here he was basically just fooling himself. That's why this sacrifice was not acceptable, because it didn't fulfill the true objective. Okay? Now, but we can understand why he wanted to bring it, because he still had a conscience, and he still desired to be in God's favor. He hadn't reached a point where he didn't care about God. He wanted God's favor, but as you pointed out, without having to work on himself. And the difference between him and Hevel is that Hevel really worked on himself. Now, what happens next? Land of the crime. Now the first case of murder. Well, yeah. His reaction, as we said, he was extremely, in Pasuk Hey, Vayichal Kayim Yod, he was extremely angry, and his face fell. So anger and depression. Two things that pretty frequently go together. Anger and depression. And then God spoke to him, and you see, Lama Charlach, why are you angry? V'lama Naflu Panecha, and why is your face falling? See, the depression comes from the fact that he failed to get what he wanted, that he was rejected, the rejection. That we understand. But what about the anger? I'm sorry, yeah? God's message is that really, well, what would you say? If you will do good, then your face will be lifted. But if not, sin lies at the door. And unto you is its desire, and you can conquer it. You can rule over it. What? Without analyzing every word, what's the basic idea, the basic message?
He has free will.
Of course he has free will, yes. That's part of it. That's
part. His own
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, what God is telling him to do is just look at yourself. See, the natural tendency, this is very big in our society today,
The natural tendency of most people, when they fail, when they don't succeed, when they fall short, is to look for scapegoats, to blame others. And this has reached a tremendous proportion in our society today. Article in the New York Times. There's an excellent article in the New York Times. Yeah, maybe we should bring and make some copies. Someone's written, this individual wrote a book about this. To the extent to which it's a society about whining.
Why is America whining?
And he's into, like, it's a totally different mentality than what it was, say, 30, 40 years ago. When today, like, every talk show, every program, it's every, there's groups you never heard of. There's every group with a new syndrome. In other words, yeah, like, a person, let's take excessive shopping. People that are addicted to shopping. So that's, I mean, years ago, a person that's going around shopping like crazy and rolling up tremendous bills, right, or even gambling like crazy, you know, too much gambling or too much basically people would not call this an illness. It wouldn't be regarded as an illness. It would be regarded as a moral kind of a thing. You have it's your decision. You have to control your impulses. Now that's the way. And no, you may need help. Sometimes a person needs help to understand why they're doing it and so on and so forth. But nobody would go so far as to say it's a syndrome or a disease, and therefore, I'm sorry?
It's not my fault.
It's not your fault. The whole thrust of today's society, I think it stems, I mean, tracing it back from, not scientifically, but I think it's basically from the 60s. Well, that's a major shift in society from the old values. Basically, a person has free will, and if there's free will, there's responsibility. No one denied there's such a thing as mental illness, but not every... Now it turns out that anything that you have a problem in, which is a result of your moral failing, well, that's an illness. So a person's addicted to shopping, a person's addicted to this, a person's addicted to the other thing, and therefore, so now they're victims. So now that's the whole idea. There's no criminals anymore, it's just victims. And each... You know, the amount of all these different groups, and once you're a group, you're a victim, and you have certain rights and certain entitlements. There's a whole system like that. So, the tendency in most people, and this tendency has to be checked, by and large, a person has to realize that his fate, see, people have this idea of mazel. Most people have the idea that when they look at other people that are successful, and there's a certain envy, so they say that person has mazel. Good mazel. They envy that. That person always has good, you know. And I don't have good mazel. Because you look at your situation, and it doesn't seem to be that good, so what does it mean? I mean, what you're really saying is that, by and large, essentially, the cause for your situation in life is really outside of yourself. But that's against the view of the Torah. One time I heard somebody say, an intelligent individual made a point, that it's not, in mazel, there is such a thing as mazel, but mazel doesn't mean luck. Mazel just means so to speak, the roll of the dice. In other words, each person has mazel. Mazel means the things that you really have no control over. Let's assume if we were to, because you come into the world, a lot of things are predetermined. That's why it says everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. The Rashi says whether you're tall or short, how intelligent, rich, poor, things like that. There are certain things that you really have no control over. Although rich and poor, you do have some control over. I guess it means you're the position from which you start out in life. You can't say that everything is in your control because a lot of things are determined before you came around. First of all, your whole genetic makeup, your whole constitution, your intelligence, how you looks play a role in this world. I mean, your health and your disposition. So all these things you didn't choose. No one asked you. Well, pick out what kind of a body would you like? You know, what color hair would you like? What kind of mind would you like? Sense of humor? You know, we'll give you nobody. Not only that, but even once you're born, what about all these events that occur in your whole upbringing? You have no control over that. Your parents, your household, your school. Right. All of these things a person has no control over. So therefore you see, it's very tempting to say, look, it's not my fault. Everything was basically, well, I had no choice. I was raised, that's the view of today's society, especially oppressed groups, they can't make it. They'll say, like, it's impossible. But the truth of the matter is that, well, that's mazel. Mazel means, like, assume you're playing a card game. So that's the role, whatever hand you wind up with. There comes a point in life when it now becomes yours. You take over. If up to a certain point, whether, I don't know what point, teenage, whenever you, the age of maturity, is not your fault. Because you can't make the decisions. You're affected by the environment you're in, the people you're around, and so on and so forth. But there does come a point in time when that becomes irrelevant. And now it's your deck. You have to play with this deck. You have to take the mazel. So really, what this person was saying, that mazel is not such a key factor, it's what you do with your mazel. It's how you handle it. In other words, we believe in the idea of free will. Which is to say that it is true that each person has a different situation that he has to cope with. And by and large, you know, you tend to look at the other person's situation. You're only looking at the, you know, the things that you want to look at. If you ask him, each person has positive and negative. There's no, God worked it out in a way. It's not like there is a leap. Like, some people are born for success and some people are born for, we don't believe in that. But we believe that in spite of all these different factors, each person always retains his free will. Except for maybe, I'm not talking about the extreme. The average individual has free will, and no matter what the situation, he can take his mazel, and he can now, once he, because he has a mind, and he has the opportunity to learn, and he can learn true ideas, especially within the framework of Klal Yisrael, and he can direct himself toward the good. And work, he can work with, God doesn't expect you. Of course, God does not expect you to be on the same level of a Moshe Rabbeinu or whatever, but that's very irrelevant. You're judged in your own framework. But each person has the ability to be a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what he says. So we just learn sheer. So I asked, how could that be? The Torah says that there'll never arise another prophet like Moshe. Moshe was the greatest level of perfection of any individual. And there'll never be another Moshe. So how can the Rambam say that each person has the capacity to be a tzaddik like Moshe? If he just told me that you could be a tzaddik, fine. But what do you mean, like Moshe? No one's going to ever be like Moshe. So what's the answer? Or Russia doesn't mean the level that you reach in terms of the human species. In terms of the human species, how far the species can go, so then Moshe reached the highest level. But in terms of the quality of tzaddik, that's a separate thing. For example, another person could be the greatest scholar of his generation. That doesn't mean it's the greatest tzaddik. Tzaddik means within your own personal framework that given your abilities and given your understanding, you chose the good. You made the most out of your capacity to act in line with the truth, in line with the good. So that person doesn't have to be the smartest one in the community, but he could be the tzaddik, the most perfected. Perfection is with regard to the nature that you have. That's what perfection is. So in that framework, that's the essential concept of Yadav, which means to say that by and large, your attitude should be that the main responsibility, the main cause for whatever it is you're experiencing in life has to be yourself. The main focus is yourself. And that the only way that a person can really achieve happiness in life is by a change within himself. Most people don't look at it that way. Most people, when they're unhappy, look at the situation. And that's why they're always involved in changing. If I could only change this in my life, if I could only change that, if I could only live there, or have this. Most people believe that their happiness or unhappiness in life is essentially related to the external situation. That's against the philosophy of the others. And of course, the more people don't learn from what you see from others, the more that you see people in our society today that attain tremendous wealth and status and everything. About this judge, the more we're amazed. I mean, while these types of things, see, again, it's a side point, but there's a difference. We've had this in the past. Also, I mean, the question is it worse today than it was in the past? Or every generation had its share of people, you know, respected people who had. No, I say it's worse. It's just too many. In other words, it used to be a very rare, exceptional thing, and you didn't find so many people who are supposed to be the representatives. Like those who represent the institutions of society, like in politics, presidents, how many presidents or candidates for presidents have been involved. Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I made that point. Not again. whatever you want to say, it's amazing to me that that issue of Clinton, whether it was that seems from the evidence and tapes that there's a very serious proof that he did have an affair, and it became that America reached a point where it's totally irritating to even raise the question. To even raise the question was wrong. Like, it's irrelevant. Nobody wants to hear about it. And that's why the Republicans didn't even harp on it. Not because of righteousness on their part. The only reason they would have brought it up would have been for political reasons. But it shows you that a few years ago, Gary Hart was a few years ago, was eliminated because he was caught in the act, whatever the case may be. But what's the difference, caught or not caught? The point was that any individual who openly is having an affair with, when he's married with another woman, lacks the character to be president. That's a serious question. Now, I'm not saying that you should not have voted for Clinton for that. I'm saying the issue should have been an issue, but we've reached the point where it's not even an issue. So I'm saying the difference in that president and how many other politicians and Supreme Court justices and how many were rejected because of immoral behavior. And that's, by the way, this is what we hear about in the paper, what you don't hear about. It seems to me that it's different. That's a very serious sign of decay in the society, where it's reached the point that even those people who are supposed to represent morality are themselves very seriously flawed. That's very, very bad. Anyways, getting back to the point here, let's understand. So what happened to Cain? What happened over here? God was trying to communicate this point to him, that you're experiencing problems. Everybody feels like Cain at some point, angry and depressed with life. He was really miserable. He was upset with life. And basically, when you're upset, you're upset with life. You're never upset with this particular thing, you're upset with life. And what God was trying to tell him was to turn inward. That the real source of your problem lies within yourself. And that may be very, very painful, but realize it's a tremendous blessing, though, because it means to say that it's within reach.
Exactly, it's within your control.
If you're going to follow the other philosophy, see, people are not consistent. If you can really believe in that philosophy, that my happiness in life is dependent upon externals, then what you're really saying is you can never be happy, because who can control the externals? I mean, it's here one day, gone the next, with people, whatever it is, whether it's job, family, friend. I mean, these things are so flighty, you can't count on any type of consistency in the externals. So if your life is dependent upon that, that's not a very strong foundation. But if it's really dependent upon the inside, then somebody once told me a story. This individual was driving by in a wealthy area where they had beautiful houses. And the people in the car were like, you know, like, look at that one. Wow, if only I could live in a house like that. So he said to them, I just want you to know one thing. You don't live inside of a house. You live inside of your mind. You live inside of your mind. That's what you really live. See, a person makes that mistake. See, that itself is a good lesson to ponder. The person, imagine, I said, yeah, why, before people get so excited about all this, why don't they go inside and visit these houses and ask the people living in there if living in this house is such an exciting phenomenon? But a person does imagine that if I just had that thing, I'd be happy forever. I wouldn't need anything else. Now, you've all had that feeling in your life. There's no doubt you've all had that feeling at a certain point. Whether it was, you know, when you fell in love with someone. When you were madly in love with someone. If you can think back. If you can try and remember. But then, or, you know, when you fell in love with a car you wanted. Any type of thing you were really gung-ho about. You always said, doesn't it carry with it that feeling that if I only get that I will never need anything else. That'll be enough to satisfy me. I'll be happy. That's it. Nothing else will ever bother me. And what happens when you get it? For a day. It's the right. But you see, the mind is playing a trick on you over there. So that's what God tried to tell him. Now what happened? What caused the first... Yeah, then you tell me that. Tell me why he was angry. Yeah, I want to understand the anatomy of this murder. Because we're going to treat it from the perspective of chet. And remember, we said before that every time a person sins, he's doing so to satisfy some need, and the act that he's performing will satisfy, will cater to that need. So, Jackie said, what was the anger about? What was he angry about? How do you understand the anger? Depressed, we understand. Depression is, you feel depleted. I didn't get what I wanted. That's natural. But why angry? No one had done anything to him. And who was he angry at? Who was he angry at? And why did he commit the crime? How does that help him anymore?
And also, since he's going to have God's title, all he had to do was redo it, and he would have been fine, but since
it's
the
Anglican steward. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. So let's, the dynamics of the crime, okay. Let's think for a few seconds. Of course. There's no doubt at all that had he brought a sacrifice to God, and God had not accepted it, he would have been unhappy. And he may have been angry, but I don't think it would have been the emphasis would have been more on the depression. He would have been upset. And he would not have killed Hevel. Let's say another scenario. Let's say he would have brought the sacrifice, God would not have accepted it, but Hevel either would have brought and Hevel would have been rejected, that's one, or Hevel had not brought a karma at all. Would he have killed Hevel in that case? No. That's a very good point Hevel is making. In other words, the cause, and that's why the Torah brings down Hevel's sacrifice in conjunction with his, it says in the pasuk, and to Cain and his offering God did not turn. Oh, it says it, and God turned to Hevel and his, and to Cain and his, he did not turn. In other words, you have to have both. These two elements are essential, that A, his was rejected, while at the same time, his was accepted. And that's what brought about the anger. Had Hevel not been accepted, or had Hevel not even brought one, then he would have been alive. He wouldn't have been killed. Yeah. Why does that work? Let's understand that. Let's understand that. What happened? Why did he get angry at him? Oh, it's still been rivalry, but that rivalry came about only because of this. Had this not happened, there wouldn't have been rivalry. It makes a good point. That who was he really angry at? Of course, in terms of the manifestation, the anger is manifested against Hevel, but that doesn't mean that it's really the ultimate object is Hevel. It could be that the ultimate object is God. Where do you see a similar example of this? What do you see from the Torah? We've gone over this case. Not Jacob, I don't know, perhaps with Yosef. The brothers, there's another case of sibling rivalry. That's a blatant case of sibling rivalry. Brought on, triggered off by Yaakov, he favored Yosef in an obvious way, and the brothers were jealous. And they sought to kill him. But if you read the story carefully, we pointed out that the real anger was directed at who? At Yaakov, at Jacob. They really, of course, the reason that they're angry is because they have a desire. They desire the love of the father. That's a tremendously important thing, to have the love of the father. And it's very important because a person's whole self-love is tied up with the love of the parents. That's one of the most powerful driving forces in a person, self-love. And that's why you get depression. The removal of that, in other words, when you need somebody's love and it's withheld, so that you feel depressed because your whole sense of self is destroyed. Your whole sense of self is dependent upon getting the love of the father. Now, in the case of sibling rivalry, they're angry because he got what they wanted. Now they're really angry at the father. The real anger is against the father for withholding it. The only thing is that psychologically, the person has too much guilt to direct his blame at the father. So therefore it's him. He's got to find an outlet for his hatred. And then the outlet will be there's something wrong with this individual. This individual is a phony, is deceiving, etc. If I only got rid of that individual, it's not me. It's not me and it's not the father. It can't be. So you can't attack the father also because then you don't have a father. You see the point. You can't attack the father for many reasons. You have to assume that the father, because you want the love of the father. Now, if you say the father is totally defective, so then you don't have a father anymore at all. Okay, so it's not the father. And it can't be, it's not me. Okay? So there's something wrong. There's somebody coming along over here and messing up the situation. It's the one who's getting the love. This person does not deserve the love, and it's a phony. Whatever the reasons, the justifications. But the anger is going to be, he stole. He stole the thing. He stole the love of the father. So therefore you hate him. If you only got rid of, if he was out of the picture, That's the way these ideas are. I'm not saying you don't think these things through. You know, if you did, you wouldn't act that way because they don't make any sense. But it's emotional thinking. The emotions are going along this track. If I only got rid of him, then the whole situation would be okay. But go ahead. He's talking about two things. There's also the element of envy.
We just have to explain that a little bit more.
There's the element of envy. That is to say, envy when somebody else gets what you want. And that's an important idea here. See, in other words, what God is trying to tell him, look at yourself. But there's more to it than just look at yourself. And that is that, what is envy? When you judge your situation by comparison with somebody else. That's an important element over here. Don't look at what's happening with him. In other words, as I said before, if he would not have brought a carbon, or if his carbon would have been rejected, or had he not brought it, then he'd be okay. Then Cain would have been all right. He would just might have been upset, but then he wouldn't have had any envy. The factor of envy comes into the picture. Envy always means that you're judging your own situation in this world by standards that apply to somebody else. That's another vital element in this whole picture over here. That a person has to judge his own situation in life purely in terms of himself. What's right for you. And that you can't, and people are upset with God. See, people are upset with God when they're envious of others. That's the last of the Asarva Dibros, Lotisava. You shouldn't be desirous of that which somebody else has. And then why is that one of the Ten Commandments? I mean, all right, so envy is bad, but it's one. It's a breach in terms of your relationship with God. Because you have to realize and you have to accept the idea that you're living in a world in which, you know, you exist and you have certain rights, and other people exist as well, and they have certain rights, and there's no such thing as equality. There's no such thing as equality except under the law. Equality under the law. Because we have a system of law, and the system of law has to operate on the principle of equality. But other than that, you're not going to have equality in the way that you would like. Equality in terms of everybody having the same skills, everybody having the same talents, everybody being as successful, everybody being as popular. All of these different things that you would like it to be. When you see somebody else, and that person, you envy. You wish you had that. That's fine. That's one thing. But you're upset and you think that there's something wrong with the situation because you don't have that, then you have a tremendous difficulty. Because you have to adapt yourself to the reality that God has given you. Because that's the only reality you're going to have. And that's acceptance of all Malka Shemayim. You have to accept that it was God's will to create the world in that way. Now, of course, if you operate intelligently, you'll realize that you have the capacity to be happy with what you have. But the emotion of envy... The emotion of envy enters into the situation. So you have those two factors. You have those two factors over here. You have the inability to recognize... See, envy prevents you. Envy prevents you from looking at yourself. You didn't have envy. These two things are interrelated. The anger with the... if you didn't have envy, then you could look at yourself. And if you could look at yourself, you'd find the defect. And then you'd correct the defect and you'd be happy. You wouldn't be looking at the other person. But because you have the envy... which means to say, the emotional defect of determining your situation and what you should have in life, I'm purely on the basis of what's happening to somebody else, that God has given that other person something which God has not given you, and therefore it's not fair determining what's right and wrong purely on the basis of what is true for somebody else. That's envy. That prevents you. That works in tandem.